From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
At 3:30 a.m. on the morning of February 29th, 2004, American Special Forces soldiers, 30 all told, surrounded the home of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide of Haiti and abducted him and his American-born wife from their home and flew them against their will out of the country into the Central African Republic. They didn't know where they were going until the American soldiers were landing in the Central African Republic. The United States of America overthrew the democratically elected government of Haiti.
TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson, author of An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. His book comes out as thousands march in Haiti for the return of exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
No, I didn't resign. What some people call resignation is a new coup d'etat or a modern kidnapping.
Today, Randall Robinson on Haiti and the removal of President Aristide for the hour. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New Pentagon statistics show the number of attacks in Iraq last month reached their highest daily average since May 2003. The data, which was obtained by Reuters, shows an upward trend in daily attacks in the 4 months since President Bush decided to escalate the war. During the month of June, there was a daily average of 178 attacks against coalition troops, Iraqi security forces, civilians, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the U.S. air war in Iraq continues. On Saturday, a U.S. helicopter struck near the town of Husaniyah, north of Baghdad. The U.S. claimed the strike killed 6 insurgents, but local police and residents said the attack killed 18 civilians and injured 21 more. Television footage showed heaps of rubble of flattened houses as people and rescuers sifted through the debris looking for bodies or injured residents. 6 bodies wrapped in blankets could be seen lined up on the ground near the rubble of one of the houses. One elderly resident condemned the U.S. attack.
This is what the occupation does. The occupation. Look at the forklift trucks. They've turned the world upside down. Our relatives have been ripped to pieces. Does God accept this? Does Muhammad accept this? Why? Are we heathens? Even Israel hasn't done anything like this. Israel did not do what America has done to us.
I think we need to do something serious.
Sunday, nearly 1,000 Iraqis rallied in Husaniyah to protest the killings. The safety of Iraq's top Shia cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, is in question after one of his top aides was assassinated on Friday in Najaf. Sheikh Abdullah Falk was stabbed to death inside his office just 40 yards away from Sistani's home. In the Iraqi city of Taji, at least 5 pro-U.S. Sunni leaders were assassinated Saturday in a suicide bombing during a meeting. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has confirmed Ambassador Ryan Crocker will take part in direct talks with Iran on Tuesday to discuss the security situation in Iraq. President Bush issued an executive order Friday that will allow the Central Intelligence Agency to resume its use of some severe interrogation methods for questioning detainees in prisons overseas. According to the New York Times, the president has given the CIA the authority to proceed with an interrogation program that had been in limbo since the Supreme Court ruled last year all prisoners in American captivity be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. The president's order requires CIA detainees, quote, receive the basic necessities of life, including adequate food and water, shelter from the elements, necessary clothing, protection from extremes of heat and cold, and essential medical care. But human rights groups condemn Bush's order, saying it will help reinforce a program of indefinite incommunicado detention. Physicians for Human Rights criticized Bush for not specifically prohibiting torture techniques used in the past, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, isolation, death threats, use of dogs, stress positions, and temperature manipulation. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin is preparing to introduce 2 censure resolutions condemning the president. Senator Feingold made the announcement on NBC's Meet the Press.
I think we need to do something serious in terms of accountability. And that's why I will be shortly introducing censure resolutions of the president and the administration. One on their getting us into the war of Iraq, in Iraq, and their failure to adequately prepare our military, and the misleading statements that have continued throughout the war in Iraq. And a second on this administration's outrageous attack on the rule of law, all the way from the illegal terrorist surveillance program to their attitude about torture, which we heard a little bit about today on this show. This administration has assaulted the Constitution.
Senator Feingold said a historical number of some kind is needed to indicate what has happened in the country under President Bush and Vice President Cheney. White House Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend has suggested the Bush administration would consider direct assaults on Pakistan in an effort to disrupt al-Qaeda hideouts. Townsend appeared on Fox News Sunday and was asked why the U.S. isn't sending special operations forces and pilotless drones into Pakistan. Townsend said no options are off the table.
President Musharraf has got over 80,000 Pakistani military troops in the Fatah, and working with us, they've sustained hundreds of casualties in this fight. We're working with them, but the president's been clear. Job number one is to protect the American people, and there are no options that are off the table.
Francis Townsend's comment came as the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Mike McConnell, admitted he believed Osama bin Laden is living in the tribal region of Pakistan. In other news from Pakistan, General Pervez Musharraf has been dealt a major political setback. On Friday, Pakistan's Supreme Court reinstated senior judge Iftikhar Chowdhury. The court ruled that Musharraf acted illegally when he suspended Chowdhury from his duties as Chief Justice in March. The president of the Karachi Bar Association, Iftikhar Javed Qazi, said the court's decision is a historic moment for the country's judiciary.
Guys are starving for independence of judiciary since 1947, and this is first ever chance when we have got a step ahead towards this direction. This is just the beginning. The restoration of Chief Justice of Pakistan to its post is the first step, and we have to go a long way for the independence of judiciary.
In Turkey, the ruling AK Party easily won parliamentary elections held Sunday, securing another term for the Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The pro-business Islamist-rooted party won 341 of the 550 seats in parliament. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has begun his first trip as special envoy for the Middle East Quartet of the U.S., Russia, European Union, and United Nations. Blair is scheduled to meet with top officials from Israel as well as Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Under the terms of his mandate, Blair is not authorized to talk to Hamas, even though Hamas won the last election in the Palestinian territories and controls the Gaza Strip. Blair's trip to the Middle East comes just days after Israel released 255 Palestinian prisoners in an attempt to bolster Abbas. The prisoners largely belong to Abbas's Fatah party. Dismissed Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas said the release of the prisoners is a trap set by Israel.
We are pleased with the release of any Palestinian prisoner, but we warn against the use of these issues as political bribes and traps set in our path under the guise of Israeli good intentions. We warn against the so-called good intentions of the Israelis.
Israel continues to hold about 11,000 Palestinians in prison. A Russian environmentalist was beaten to death Saturday while protesting outside a nuclear waste processing plant in Siberia. According to Russian news reports, a group of 20 people armed with iron bars and baseball bats attacked the protest camp near the nuclear plant. Seven other protesters were injured. In news from Africa, the New York Times is reporting the Ethiopian government is putting hundreds of thousands of people at risk of starvation by blockading emergency food aid and choking off trade to eastern parts of the country. The area affected is home to the Ogaden National Liberation Front, a rebel group that's opposed the current government. One humanitarian official accused Ethiopia of trying to starve out the population. He said, quote, "If something isn't done on the diplomatic front soon, we're going to have a government cause famine on our hands." The official refused to be quoted by name because he feared reprisals against the aid workers. The New York Times also reports the U.S.-backed Ethiopian military and its proxy militias have been siphoning off millions of dollars in international food aid and using a U.N. polio eradication program to funnel money to pro-government fighters. In other news from Ethiopia, the government released 38 opposition members and activists Friday, 4 days after they were sentenced to life in prison. The government released the men following an outcry from the international human rights community. Haile Shawal, the chair of Ethiopia's Coalition for Unity and Democracy Party, was one of the prisoners released.
We are finally out, but we hope the Ethiopian people also will be out of all this mess we are in, and we will change this country for the better. We hope everyone will participate in the next discussion we will have so that all Ethiopians will come together and build a new Ethiopia.
The opposition members were arrested after the disputed elections in 2005. In Texas, supporters of death row prisoner Kenneth Foster rallied at the state capitol Saturday. Foster scheduled to be executed August 30th under a controversial Texan law known as the Law of Parties. The law imposes the death penalty on anybody involved in a crime where a murder occurs. In Foster's case, he was driving a car 11 years ago with three passengers. One of the passengers left the car, got into an altercation, and shot a man dead. At the time of the shooting, Kenneth Foster was 80 feet away in his car, but he was convicted of murder. Since Foster's original trial, the other men in the car that night have testified Foster had no idea a shooting was going to take place. And India has elected its first female president. Pratibha Patil will be sworn into office on Wednesday. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 10,000 people marched in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince last Sunday. They were calling for the return of the exiled president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. It was his 54th birthday. This is Haitian folk singer and Lavalas leader Annette Auguste, more well known as Soane, speaking at the rally.
It is a nice way to say happy birthday to President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who is in exile in South Africa today. There are people watching the final between Brazil and Argentina. Still, it is good to see so many of the population who took to the streets for a good cause. I always say that since December of 1991, nothing has changed for the population.
Today's rally shows that the majority of the Haitian people are asking for the return of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. If there is a state of right existing in Haiti today, it is just for the government of President René Préval to do the right thing. It is unjust to have this politician in exile.
President Aristide will come back, and when he does, we will all cry for victory, because the real hope is with President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, not with Préval.
On February 29, 2004, 3 years ago, the democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, was removed from office by the United States and flown to the Central African Republic. 2 weeks later, in defiance of the United States, a delegation led by California Congressmember Maxine Waters and TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson chartered a plane and headed off to the Central African Republic themselves to bring President Aristide and his wife Mildred back to the Caribbean. I accompanied them on that trip. After hours of negotiating with the dictator in the capital, Bangui, they freed the Aristides. As we flew back over the Atlantic, President Aristide said he'd been kidnapped in a U.S.-backed coup d'etat.
I will not go to details, maybe next time, but as I said, they use force. When you have militaries coming from abroad, surrounding your house, taking control of the airport, surrounding the National Palace, being in the streets, and take you from your house to put you in a plane where you have to spend 20 hours without knowing where they were going to go with you, without talking about details, which I already did somehow in other occasions. It was using force to take an elected president out of his country.
And was that U.S. military force that took you out?
There were U.S. military, and I suspect it could be also completed with the presence of other militaries from other countries.
When they came to your house in the early morning of February 29th, was it U.S. military that came?
There were diplomats, there were U.S. military, there were U.S. people.
The Bush administration said that after you got on the plane, when you were leaving, you spoke with CARICOM leaders. Is this true?
They lied. I never had any opportunity from February 28 at night when they started to the minute I arrived in Kabul. I never had any conversation with anyone from CARICOM within that framework of time.
How many U.S. military were on the plane?
I cannot know how many were there, but I know it's a plane with 55 seats. Among them, we had 19 American agents. The rest, they were American militaries.
Were they dressed in military uniform?
They were not only dressed with their uniform. It was like if they were going to war for the first period of time. On the ground, when we went to the plane, after the plane took off, that's the way they were. Then they changed, moving from the uniform to other kind of clothes.
Civilian?
Yes.
And did they go with you all the way to the Central African Republic?
They did, without telling me where they were taking me, without telling me how long it would take us to be there.
Exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in a plane heading back to the Caribbean. Then it was to Jamaica. It's now more than 3 years later. The Aristides remain in exile in South Africa. And Randall Robinson has just written a book called An Unbroken Agony, Haiti from Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. He flew in from the Caribbean island of St. Kitts last night and joins us in our Firehouse studio today. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Randall Robinson.
Thank you.
Well, it's been 3 years since you and Congressmember Maxine Waters, Sharon Hay Webster, the member of parliament from Jamaica, led that delegation on this small plane to the Central African Republic, actually won the release of the Aristides and brought them to Jamaica. Talk about that as you watch President Aristide 3 years ago in the plane that you were in as well. What you have learned since?
Well, I talked to a number of witnesses, eyewitnesses to the abduction itself, witnesses in Antigua who saw the plane on the ground, airport officials, and of course witnesses to the whole operation and things that have gone on in Haiti.
Why don't you flesh out that entire experience that President Aristide was just talking about as you understand it today? What happened February 29th, 2004?
Well, Franz Gabriel was the president's helicopter pilot. Franz Gabriel was a sergeant in the U.S. military and a Haitian citizen who'd gone home to serve in the government and to helicopter the president around. At about 3 o'clock on the morning of the 29th, he was called by one of the Haitian security people at the president's home in Tabar and told that something wrong was developing in the president's house. I had placed a call to the president earlier that evening on the 28th, and a voice that didn't belong to the house answered the phone. It was an American voice, a male American voice, and I said, "May I speak to President Aristide? He's not here. May I speak to Madame Aristide, his American-born wife, Mildred Trujillo Aristide?" and she's not here. When will they be? And I'm cut off. I became concerned. I'd never heard a strange voice answer their private phones before. We had, my wife Hazel had worked to arrange a visit of Tavis Smiley to Haiti on the 29th. He was to interview the president downtown in central Port-au-Prince at the palace about this, this turmoil that was unfolding in the north of the country. The rebels, armed by the United States, had entered the country early in February, moved north and away from the capital, and never showed, never demonstrated any inclination to attack Port-au-Prince. And so we were concerned in the United States because most of us didn't know that they posed no threat to the Democratic government. And so Tavis was going there to interview the president, and George Stephanopoulos was to interview him as well. And so after I was unable to reach the president, Tavis Smiley called me. Or called my wife, because my wife was the one who was organizing his visit. He said, the visit's off. And my wife said, oh, no, has something happened to them? And Tavis said, no, I just got a call from Secretary of State Colin Powell. And Secretary of State Powell said to me
Tavis
said that he got a call from Ron Dellums. And Ron Dellums also worked with my wife on the Haiti team. And Ron Dellums reported to Tavis that he had just gotten a call from Secretary of State Colin Powell, and that the secretary said that Guy Philippe, the leader of the paramilitaries, the American armed and trained paramilitaries, was coming to Port-au-Prince on Sunday to kill the president. And I want you, Ron Dellums, to let the president know that this is going to happen, and let him know that the United States will do nothing to protect him. And so Tavis said, of course, the trip is off. And then my wife called Ron Dellums. And Ron said, yes, I've just heard from the secretary. And Guy Philippe is in Port-au-Prince and will kill Aristide tomorrow, according to Secretary of State Powell, who had to have known that Guy Philippe was nowhere near Port-au-Prince. President Aristide, of course, knew because he had gotten reports from Franz Gabriel. The idea was to frighten Aristide into abdicating his office and fleeing the country on a plane provided by the United States, and the Aristides refused. Later that morning, about 30 American Special Forces troops in full combat gear and 12 or 13 white Chevy Suburbans of the American Embassy surrounded the Aristide home, took positions on the wall around the home, and you could see the red tracer pattern crisscrossing, crosshatching in the yard of the home, and into the yard came one Chevy Suburban with one of the special forces people fully armed who was attending Luis Moreno of the American Embassy, who walked into the house and told the president, I was here when you came back in 94, and I'm here tonight to tell you it's time for you to leave. They removed the president, Moreno, and the American special forces from his home, took them to the airport. The president, Mrs. Aristide, and Franz Gabriel took them from their home, boarded them on this large, wide-bodied aircraft with no markings, no tail number, only the sort of large flag, American flag, on the vertical tail assembly, and flew off, making their first refueling stop in the Eastern Caribbean in Antigua. Friends of ours at the airport in Antigua, airport officials, were not allowed to board the plane, as is the custom, for customs purposes. All of the windows were drawn. The plane sat on the tarmac for 5 hours or so. And Secretary Rumsfeld said that when President Aristide was in Antigua, he had met with members of the Caribbean leadership community. President Aristide, as he said on the tape, is quite right, and this is borne out by witnesses in Antigua, couldn't have known where he was. He was not allowed to see out of the plane, and no one on the outside was allowed access to anyone who was on the plane. And as I've published in the book, I've published copies of the American customs declarations. And one of the declarations has been altered from 50 present on the plane to no people on the plane by the Americans who submitted the customs declarations to the Antiguan authorities. And then they flew off to the Ascension Island. And only when they were approaching the Central African Republic were the Aristides told where they were. And after they landed, no American official deplaned. No soldiers, no one else. The Aristides were simply put off the plane as if they were parcels, along with Franz Gabriel. They weren't even told or treated or given any medication for this sometimes lethal malaria strand that affects the Central African Republic, and were kept there in a small room for 2 weeks until our delegation arrived to try and negotiate their relief.
We'll find out what happened after. This is Randall Robinson. He's just written a book called An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. Stay with us. What a plot here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR, and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. And our headlines are also available in Spanish in transcript and audio form for any radio station to take around the world. About 150 are. You can, too. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Randall Robinson. He's just flown up from St. Kitts in the Caribbean, where he has lived for the past 6 years. He's written a new book. It's called An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. Randall Robinson is founder and past president of TransAfrica, also author of The Debt, The Reckoning, and Defending the Spirit. Randall Robinson, you just described that day, February 29th, into March 1st, as the Aristides were taken by the U.S. military and security from their home in Haiti to the Central African Republic. Why CAR, the Central African Republic?
Any number of Caribbean countries would have welcomed the Aristides. But the United States wanted to get him out of the hemisphere, as far away from Haiti as they possibly could. And they wanted to send him to a country over which either the United States or France had great sway. The Central African Republic is de facto still a colony of France. And it was under military dictatorship at the time that that President Aristide was taken there. And so when we arrived, we saw Cheikh Bajau to the airport was a French military establishment. It was no common civilian use airport. There were no planes. It was a very a frightening affair. Troops were all about. Obviously, the president was very nervous. Was very nervous about threats to his one-year-old military coup, and so that's how he was sent there, and that's how that country was chosen. And it, President Bozizi made plain to us that he had done this at the request of the of the United States. Now, Prime Minister Patterson of Jamaica demonstrated enormous courage in giving to his parliamentarian, Sharon Hay A. Webster, who went with us, a letter saying that he would welcome to providing temporary refuge, asylum, to President Aristide in Jamaica. And it was with the presentation of that letter that we were able to prevail, but not before President Bozizi had to call France and the United States to seek permission to release the Aristides to us. It was clear that the United States was in control and that President Bozizi was doing this at the request of the, of the United States.
We were reporting back to Pacifica and to Reuters following these hours of negotiations. As you negotiated with the president, went to the presidential palace, the decision was being made, are the Aristides going to be released? But the U.S. had an unusual situation here. They said that the Aristides had chosen to go there, were free to leave, and yet here you were negotiating, not with them, but with the dictator for their release.
Oh, it's absolutely clear that they weren't free to go anywhere. And Bozizi made that clear. The Aristides had never been to that country before, knew no one in that country, and certainly wouldn't have gone to a country that was a virtual colony of France, because France was implicated in the coup with the United States. I think Secretary Powell confesses much of his role in a recent statement that that he made. He said on April the 18th, he says, if there are people who don't want American troops there, should they be there, was the question. It depends. They're there because they serve our interest, American troops, and they also hopefully serve the interests of the country. In the case of Haiti, Haiti is an example where we were not invited in, but there was a civil war. There was no civil war, and the secretary knew that.
On March 1st, 2004, Democracy Now! Broke the story because you, Randall Robinson, and Congressmember Maxine Waters called us right after President Aristide called you, saying he was trapped in the Central African Republic. We broke the story that Aristide was directly accusing the United States of overthrowing him in a coup, kidnapping him and taking him and his wife Mildred by force to the Central African Republic. So that day, after we broadcast your and Congressmember Maxine Waters' descriptions of that scratchy phone call that President Aristide had made to you from the CAR, our transcripts went online. Reporters took those transcripts and questioned U.S. officials, both at the Pentagon and the White House, about Aristide's accusations. Then Secretaries of Defense and State Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell responded.
The idea that someone was abducted is just totally inconsistent with everything I heard or saw or am aware of. So I think I do not believe he is saying what you say are saying he is saying.
He was not kidnapped. We did not force him onto the airplane. He went onto the airplane willingly, and that's the truth.
And that's the truth, says then Secretary of State Colin Powell. Your response, Randall Robinson?
Well, several things. Number one, a cursory investigation would demonstrate the factual accuracy of what I have described here. The Caribbean countries asked for an investigation, and they were told by the United States that were they to press for an investigation at the UN Security Council level, that either France or the United States or both would veto such a resolution. And so the U.S. was prepared to block any investigation into what they had done that night. Of course the president didn't go on the plane voluntarily. All of the previous coups that have occurred in Haiti of dictators that were there with the support of the United States when they were chased out of a country, all of the cameras were there to record that. Then they were taken to nearby places like Panama to live comfortably. The U.S. even renting the house of Cedros in Haiti, taking care of these American client dictators. When Aristide left the country, there was no camera, not one reporter at the airport. And you did what no other American journalist, save Eisner of the Washington Post, was willing to do. The New York Times suggested in their description that President Aristide left Haiti and went to South Africa, never even reported that they were taken to the Central African Republic.
You also point out in An Unbroken Agony the video clips that the media was showing after Aristide left. I mean, here you had, they were not at the airport, yet they did show video of President Aristide shaking hands with dignitaries, I think, at the airport.
Making his way along a long line of government ministers in daytime clips. Making his way along a line, leaving the country. And that was represented to the American public to be a film of his departure from the country. He left the country at 4 a.m., boarded a plane at the airport with absolutely nobody there.
Randall Robinson, I interviewed Colin Powell's former chief of staff, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, on Haiti, about Haiti, November 2005. He defended the U.S. role in the removal of President Aristide from power. He said it was the U.S. that pressed him to leave, that pushed him out, that put him onto this plane with a U.S. military and security. He had no idea where he was going until he was dumped in the Central African Republic.
I can't imagine a man like Aristide, whose will to power is excessive, even obsessive, saying anything differently. Colin Powell, as you said, did know the situation in Haiti, probably as well as anyone in America. Colin Powell made the decision based on our ambassador in Haiti's very clear presentation of the circumstances. And the president made the decision ultimately, and it was a good decision, and I would stand by that decision. Haiti is a situation that picks at all our hearts all the time. Haiti is right next to being a failed state. And because of its proximity to the United States, we know what that failure means. And Haiti is not apparently capable of coming out of that situation. It's a situation that, as I said, drags at all our hearts. But in this particular instance, I think a good decision was made, a decision that prevented further bloodshed that would have been widespread had it not been made.
Why say that the president, Aristide, had an obsessive, had an obsession with power? This was a man who was the democratically elected president of Haiti, certainly got a higher percentage of the vote than President Bush got in this country.
And please don't refer to the percentage of vote as equatable to democracy, as equatable to the kinds of institutions we have reflecting democracy in America. Hitler was elected by popular vote.
I spoke to the head of the Steele Foundation. That was the American foundation that provided the security for the people around President Aristide, who was not allowed to send in reinforcements. Again, since we're talking about such a small group of people who were moving in on the Capitol, the Steele Foundation felt he could be secured, but the U.S. government stopped Aristide's own security from being able to come in.
Aristide felt like he couldn't be secured. That's the only, I mean, I was privy to the cables that came in from our ambassador. I was privy to some of the information that the secretary let me know about what was happening down there in terms of telephone calls and so forth. Aristide made the decision deep into the night that his life was in danger and that the bloodshed that would occur would probably fall at his feet. And so Aristide made a mutual decision with our ambassador to leave the country.
Why?
Despite what he says now, that's what the record reflects.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff of the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell, Randall Robinson.
Well, here are the facts. No one disputes that the United States provided weapons, uniforms, steel pots, recoilless rifles, rocket-powered grenades, all of that, to some 200 paramilitary forces that were trained in the Dominican Republic. The U.S. armed and trained them. No one disputes that they crossed the border, went north, away from the capital, and stopped at Gonaive, at least 100 kilometers north of Port-au-Prince, which was where they were spotted, verifiably, on the evening of the 28th and the morning of the 29th. They never came near Port-au-Prince. No one in Haiti would dispute that they ever posed a threat to the government. No 200 armed men could overrun a city of a million people that were hostile to them and supportive of the president. The president won two elections, the last with 90% of the vote. If he were in Haiti today and he ran again, he would win overwhelmingly again. The United States provided money through the International Republican Institute to form a false opposition to Aristide in the country, the rich and the elites, who were threatened because he raised the minimum wage from $1 to $2 a day, threatened because he had proposed to banish the use of the word peasants on the birth certificate of poor black Haitians, threatened by a man who was loved by his people because he wanted to protect the interests of the poorest among them. And the United States overthrew that democracy. And it is so simply provable. The smallest investigation would prove what the United States has done in this case.
We're talking to Randall Robinson in Unbroken Agony, Haiti, from revolution to the kidnapping of a president. When we come back, we'll talk about what the U.S. continues to do in Haiti. We'll also talk about France's role. And we'll talk about Randall Robinson not living anymore in this country, as he put it in a previous book, Quitting America. Stay with us.
Tous ces saillots qu'a fait tous ces si nous elle en figuine de l'eau coulée, c'est pas crier n'a pas crié. Nous sommes la conscience qui campait, qui cachait, cap analysé. Va la fille m'en v'lait méchanceté. La fille m'en dit m'la qu'ils auraient outendé. La fille m'en c'est maîtresse caille qui commandait. La vie m'est pas quitter la personne fâchée. Pour l'ouvrir porte la pour lui foutre force ou aller. La personne quand j'ai plusieurs fois, là sous les liés en détroit pas, subitation par l'issé loi. Pati ou gant en coulika, ti Jean-Marie, ti Nicolas, qui t'a qu'à faire marcher ou pas. La personne compte ça, ça veut dire la vie détruit pour bailler la vie. Pas qu'à pédit, ça pas pédit. La vie m'a dit m'la qu'ils auraient outendé. La vie m'a c'est maître Sky qui commandé. La vie m'a pas quitté la personne.
Mona Charlemagne here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, our guest for the hour, Randall Robinson, just up from St. Kitts, where he has been living for the last 6 years. He's just published a new book called An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. Let's talk history for a minute, something the U.S. press doesn't give us very much of. To understand the U.S. role today in Haiti, can you go back in time to how Haiti was founded in 1804?
Well, Haiti was the largest piece of France's global empire. It was its great profit center, that slave colony with 465,000 enslaved Africans working there, many of whom had been soldiers in African armies before they were brought to Haiti. And in August of 1789, 40,000 of those slaves revolted and started a war that lasted 12 and a half years under the leadership of an ex-slave named, and a military genius named Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines. And this army of ex-slaves defeated armies, two French armies. The French army before the completion of their revolution, and then another army dispatched by Napoleon under the leadership of his brother-in-law, and then the armies of England and Spain. 150,000 blacks died in that 12 and a half year war. And in January of 1804, they declared Haiti the first free republic in the Americas, because the United States was then a country that held slaves. During the Revolution, Thomas Jefferson said he would like to reduce Toussaint to starvation. George Washington lamented vilified that revolution. The U.S. imposed an embargo, recognized the new French government, but did not recognize the new Haitian free government, and imposed a comprehensive economic embargo on Haiti until the Emancipation Proclamation. In fact, France imposed reparations on Haiti in 1825, and the interest that Haiti had to pay in loans that were American and French loans to service this debt to France absorbed virtually 80% of Haiti's available budget 111 years after the completion of their revolution until 1915. It was only in 1947 that France, that Haiti was able to pay off its debt.
The debt that that was incurred as a result of France not having access to the enslaved people of Haiti.
The Haitians had to pay France for no longer having the privilege of owning Haitian slaves. That revolution provoked the end of slavery in the Americas. And so that's why it is so important that all African people, people generally in the Americas, because Haiti funded and fought in South American revolutions. That's why Haiti is so honored in places like Venezuela by people like Simón Bolívar. Haiti was central to all of this, and we are in Haiti's debt. But it is for that.
Simón Bolívar came to Haiti.
Haiti, and was given arms, and was given men, was given a printing press, because the Haitians believe that anybody who was enslaved anywhere had a home and a refuge in Haiti. Anybody seeking freedom had a sympathetic ear in Haiti. But because of that, the United States and France and the other Western governments, even the Vatican, made them pay for so terribly long. It's as if the anger of it never abated. I mean, you can hear Frederick Douglass talking about it in the late 1800s, about this thing in the American crawl.
The U.S. government didn't recognize Haiti for decades. The Congress, going back to Thomas Jefferson, afraid that the slave uprising would inspire U.S. slaves.
Would inspire U.S. slaves to revolt against him at in Virginia, and George Washington, and on and on and on. And so they opposed everything that was being done in Haiti to win their freedom.
The U.S. government invaded Haiti in 1915 under Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson invaded Haiti in 1915, and when a Haitian, Peralte, Charlemagne Peralte, organized the Caicos soldiers, these farmers, to fight against this American occupation. The Americans killed him and nailed him to a cross, crucifixion style, and stood him up, his corpse, in a public place in Haiti to demonstrate to Haitians what would be the price of any defense against the American invasion. The U.S. has had
has played a terrible role
in Haiti.
So
even as the U.S. and France were at loggerheads after the U.S. invasion of Iraq because France opposed the invasion, that was 2003. In 2004, they were working together.
Working very much together.
Pushing out, forcing out Aristide and bringing him to the Central African Republic.
As a matter of fact, in 2003, late 2003, Aristide organized a reparations conference, and the result of which was a request to France that it repair Haiti by repaying Haiti the $21 billion in current money that Haiti had paid in reparations unjustly to France. Dominique de Villepin responded by sending his sister.
The foreign minister of France.
The foreign minister of France, sending his sister to Haiti to tell Aristide that it was time for him to leave. And that's how we have the Western world, France, and particularly the United States, have meddled in Haitian affairs. After the abduction of the president, Bush spoke with Chirac on the phone, congratulating each other about how smoothly the abduction of the president had been carried off by both countries.
We're talking to Randall Robinson. Let's talk about today. René Préval was elected president after the U.S. Installed Gerard Latortue after Aristide was forced out. What about today in Haiti? We see this protest of thousands last week on Aristide's 54th birthday calling for the exiled president to return. He's in South Africa. What's happening today?
Well, many of the people who were trained by the United States to pretend over the president are still very much in place. They've not been apprehended. The business class that contributed money to the rebels, to the first coup, they contributed money for people who would shoot into the into any crowd of demonstrators. This time around, they contributed money. We're now hearing from Guy Philippe to him to do what he did. And so you have this collaboration between white, mulatto, wealthy elites in Haiti with the United States and Western Europe to repress the large black majority. That continues. Some 4,000 people have been killed by the international forces in Haiti since then. The Supreme Court has been replaced in large part by the interim government that was installed by the United States. So Préval's government has no control over the judiciary. We don't have an authentic democracy.
Randall, you talked about how when President Aristide was president, before he was forced out, he was supposed to be getting hundreds of millions of dollars from the Inter-American Development Bank, I think it was, for health issues.
The loan had been fully approved. It was for $146 million. It was for health issues, for literacy, for things associated with social programs, roads, and some infrastructure projects. The United States blocked that loan. And so, on the one hand, it starved the economy of Haiti. On the other hand, it trained the opposition. On another hand, it armed the paramilitaries. And in the last analysis, American forces invaded and abducted the president.
Today, apparently last week, there was an attempt to arrest Guy Philippe. Guy Philippe, who is the U.S. supported. In fact, you said in your book that he was trained in Ecuador.
He was. Plucked by the CIA for special training by the United States when he was a police captain in the Del Mar district of Port-au-Prince.
So one of the coup leaders, along with Jodel Chamblain, the number two man in
FRAP, the coup leaders,
paramilitary death squad,
is now running from the DEA, apparently. And he says through his deputy that that's the case because he is prepared to use information about how the elites in Haiti gave him money to destabilize the government.
But he wasn't arrested.
No, he hasn't been arrested yet, so far as
we
know.
They didn't get him.
No.
The U.S. role, how well known is it in Haiti by Haitians?
Oh, and I think it's very well known in Haiti by Haitians. If it were so well known by Americans, our democracy would work better. The problem is with our democracy. It wasn't ever with theirs. The problem is what our undemocratic, or the behavior of undemocratic behavior of our government means for struggling democracies across the world. That we feel that we, by divine right, can go in and overthrow governments willy-nilly when they are living under leadership of their own clear choice. It's a shameful chapter for Americans, and particularly for this administration.
Randall Robinson, you quit America, as you put it, wrote the book Quitting America. You live in St. Kitts right now in the Caribbean. What is it like to look at the United States from that perspective? You lived here for years, headed Trans-Africa for a quarter of a century, spearheaded the movement to stop the support of apartheid South Africa. You fasted almost to death, 27 days to protest President Clinton's handling of the Haitian refugees in the first coup against Aristide.
I can give you an illustrative example. When Vieques was in the news and the American use of that area as a bombing range, and the people are becoming very upset because of high cancer rates and that sort of thing, a member of the American Congress spoke to the Prime Minister of St. Kitts about, with a straight face, about the possibility of using the Americans making use of the island nation of St. Kitts as a bombing range. This is a thing, one of the kinds of things that we do and how we see the rest of the world. And I think it, in large part, is why we have come to be, as a nation, loathed so much. And so when Americans look at themselves, they see an America that is very different from what the rest of the world gets to see.
Will you be returning to the United States to live?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, I love St. Kitts. I wanted to live, I'm 66 years old. I wanted to live some of my life out from under the weight of racism, the weight of a sort of cauterized public empathy, or the lack thereof. I'm not sure anymore that entire cultures cannot be sociopathic, where they refuse to see what they do to other people in other places. It wore me out. I wanted to see a different place, and we wanted our daughter to have her adolescence and her high school in a different place. And it is a country of my wife, and so we're quite at home. It is a small, intimate, wonderful democracy, and very pretty to look at.
Randall Robinson, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Randall Robinson is the founder and former president of Trans-Africa, moved to St. Kitts in the Caribbean 6 years ago, has written a number of books, including The Debt, The Reckoning, Quitting America, Defending the Spirit. His latest is An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. If you'd like a copy of today's broadcast, a DVD, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Angelique Comet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks also to Matthew O'Neill, Elizabeth Press, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Laura Shipley, Samantha Chambly. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.